Moitas gracias. Imos facer agora, entón, un pequeno debate. Dispomos de algún tempo, até as 11:30, na que, conxuntamente, cas cuestións suscitadas na ponencia, rogaríamos, suxeriríamos tamén que se introduciran estes debates ao fío pois, do documento, porque queremos ser o máis conclusivos posible para relacionar, e así o indicamos ao ponente, estes temas que ten abordado co documento e co texto que estamos elaborando colectivamente como reflexión estratégica. Por lo tanto, pretendemos que haxe unha continuidade entre este debate e o seguinte, pónese introducir todo tipo de cuestións en a completa sesión da mañán, calesquera que sexa, abrindo así todo tipo de posibilidades. Por lo tanto, sen máis, procedemos a comezar o debate.
Ben, bons días e despois de felicitalo pola súa ponencia porque foi moi clara, moi ben articulada, eu quería plantexar un problema que despois para nós vai nos servir, penso eu, para análise concreto do noso documento. E o problema que eu quería plantexar era a ver se podíamos profundizar un pouco máis, é dicir, na comparación entre o discurso programático, é dicir, que fan tanto que fan os intelectuales, como que fan as distintas organizacións, é dicir, coas prácticas reales que despois levan a cabo. A min gustaríame, por exemplo, recordar nos orixenes de todo, é dicir, os dous textos aqueles de Lévi-Strauss, é dicir, o texto do 47, a conferencia aquela, Race et Histoire, e despois, 20 anos despois, no 67, é dicir, aquela outra conferencia, Race et Culture. É dicir, cando el na primeira, é dicir, facía referencia, digamos, como a diversidade cultural é un valor, é dicir, e, polo tanto, a manter, é dicir, un dos grandes valores de tal, como a riqueza das especies e todo eso, ele insistía moito que non se trataba de manter as diferencias, sino de manter o feito das diferencias, claro, que explica que eso, diríamos, podíase cambiar, pero podíase cambiar según aquelo estilo e tal. E despois, cando, 20 anos despois, volve sobre o mismo tema, a UNESCO, a verdad, non fixera gran cousa en eso, por eso organizan aquela segunda conferencia que el pronuncia Race et Culture. Entonces, o que el plantexa en aquel momento é, diríamos, que é necesario, un pouco, por que está fallando isto anterior? E cando di claro, porque que cada vez máis, é dicir, as culturas, en vez de entender a común transversal que ten que afectar a economía, os estilos de vida, etc., seguímola plantexando como un producto. É dicir, e aquí, isto hasta aquí na teoría. Na práctica, despois, é dicir, o que fai a UNESCO, eu creo que, claro, aí estaban as grandes oposicións entre o universalismo e os particularismos, en vez de optar, tira, ao meu ver, pola vía do medio. E a mí había do medio sobre todo en un campo, é dicir, pongamos en el mercado cada uno nuestras particularidades e eso es lo que despois terminará construyendo la ciudadanía, lo que terminará construyendo el encuentro entre las culturas y entre las personas. Claro, é dicir, o problema é que eso, é dicir, es puro rollo, es pura filfa, é dicir, despois, na práctica real, que a cultura... usted señalaba na súa ponencia, sigue sendo un producto, é dicir, sigue sendo un mercado, é dicir, cada vez mejor empaquetado, como o resto das mercancías, non? E aí temos os contedores culturales, que si la Billet, que si el Guggenheim, que si la Ciudad de la Cultura, que si non sei que, donde, como pasa no Corte Inglés, é dicir, es máis importante la caja que lo que tiene dentro. Non? Claro, o problema é que posibilidades reales hai de construir. Porque, claro, decir, para mí, por exemplo, é moi atractivo, dentro dos que citou, o discurso de Verena Stolke, por exemplo. Pero, claro, o problema é que aquí quedamos palabras contra palabras. É dicir, como se pode, decir, con este discurso, diría, de considerar, pretender construir la Europa de los pueblos, de los ciudadanos, é dicir, y, mientras al final sigue siendo la Europa de las mercancías, el mundo de las mercancías, porque a nivel de globalización o mesmo... cómo se puede inflexionar esta línea, pero sobre todo a nivel práctico. ¿No? Sería un planteamiento que a mí me gustaría menos profundizar en esa discusión, porque después é que nos vamos a ter o mesmo problema, si non estamos facendo unha teoría máis.
That's a very difficult question to answer because, in fact, what you've done very usefully is introduce a number of other strands into the reflection. So you've complexified our reflection, which is good. And I don't think one can simply give some kind of a one-size-fits-all reply. It seems to me that the role of any intellectual debate is to really express as best we can the collective wisdom of a group, of a collective group that is larger than this group. And then the actual implementation is for people who have both a commitment to culture and a political sense. That is, you're not going to be an effective minister of culture or head of culture at the local level unless you can combine the two. And I'm not the second kind of person. So I might sort of use the old joke that's used to be current in the United States when policy advice was given by academics, and the academics would be asked this kind of, how do you do it? And they would say, well, I'm into planning, not into implementation. And so I'm going to have to sort of...
This is the problem.
Yeah, well, I mean, you got to find yourselves a good public official. Here you have one, so...
Bueno, no, pero yo soy un intelectual, no un, no un político.
Tesis 11 sobre folla.
It's like, for example, in France, if you look at the really effective people who've been ministers of culture, André Malraux, Jacques Lang, and although he's no longer minister, Renaud Dondieu de Vabre, all three of them were consummit politicians. Malraux was not in the hierarchy of the party, but he was a friend of de Gaulle's, and de Gaulle really relied on him. Lang was a key element in the public image of the Socialist Party. He was one of the people who was creating hegemony in the Gramscian sense for Mitterrand. And Renaud Dondieu de Vabre is an extremely seasoned politician, and each of the three were able to achieve, in terms of French cultural policy making, some very significant results. Because they were able to listen to what the cultural sector was saying and impose then certain ideas and certain lines of their own that became practical.
Eu quería plantearlle unha cuestión, non sei exactamente como é, cando é, pero entendo que é inminente unha nova negociación do GATT como a que houbo uns anos atrás e onde se pelexou moito o argumento da excepción cultural, non? Entendo que para preservar a diversidade e bueno, eu quería felicitarlo, encantoume a súa exposición e están claros os problemas que ese argumento os problemas que derivan del, non? Quería preguntar nunha nova negociación do GATT, cree que ese argumento debería ser outra vez barallado, debería ser defendido o argumento da excepción cultural ou cree que non?
No, I think that the big discussion is taking place already, and in a way it's almost like a diplomatico-political game that has been played, because it doesn't really matter, it's not important. I'll explain why. But on the other side, it is very important. And this, so I'm sounding a bit ambiguous. I'll tell you why that is. The 2005 UNESCO Convention on the Protection and Promotion of the Diversity of Cultural Expressions was actually part of a worldwide diplomatic strategy that was put together by France and Canada to actually secure cultural exception. And they... For political reasons, they transubstantiated the word
exception and they made it diversity. Everybody loves diversity, but you don't like exception. It means, you know, you're being kind of arrogant French again, wanting to be exceptional. And so it suited the French political class to say, we are talking about diversité culturelle. We're defending the diversity, cultural diversity of everybody, okay? And the real positive outcome of the convention is that it is the first international treaty of that kind of power and solemnity that really tells governments, who are parties to the convention obviously, but all governments, that they have a responsibility to the production of, in relation to the production of cultural goods and services. And it's quite clear that everywhere in the world, not just in France or in Spain, but in Chad or in Burma or wherever, it is important to be able to be part of this new industrial and digital environment to the extent that it is feasible, to the extent that a small country is able to do it. So what it does, the convention, is actually empower the lobbies, the groups within all of those countries, to actually then lobby with their governments, and it gives government officials who are motivated, elected officials as well as appointed officials, administrative officials, also a kind of legitimization, a charter to do certain things. What is very interesting with the convention, however, is that we know that the word cultural diversity, which was used first in the anthropological sciences, refers to difference of all kinds. And that in many parts of the world, they're not interested that much in cultural goods and services. You may have minorities that, who are interested in getting more recognition from a central state. You have lifestyle enclaves. You have indigenous groups in much of the countries of the south, but also in the north, in Canada, in Scandinavia, and so on. I was in Belo Horizonte in Brazil a year and a half ago for a big conference around the convention, and the representative of Brazil, instead of talking about cultural goods and services, the official representative of the Minister of Culture, it wasn't the minister, who came, he said, we are a country in Brazil, we love cultural diversity. Look, yesterday President Lula was at the opening of Brazil's biggest gay and transgender conference, and he hugged the transgender president of the conference. We love cultural diversity. So clearly, what for the Brazilians, they are talking about another kind of cultural diversity that is not at all a topic of the convention. And now there's a very interesting dynamic that is being played out across the world, because all kinds of groups, subnational, are now going to their governments and saying, but there is now a canon of cultural diversity. Read the preamble of the convention, because all of the right ideas are in the preamble. Then you go to the operating paragraphs, and the operating paragraphs are really only about cultural goods and services. They're not about anything else. They're not about linguistic rights. They're not about minority ethnic rights. They're not about anything else. And in relation to the WTO framework, which is where negotiations, trade negotiations now take place, there's a kind of a, you might say, an increasing interest on the part of the WTO. They realize that this convention is here to stay. They realize that the cultural exception is probably here to stay. The Americans are being pushed by their lobbies, Hollywood and the audiovisual industry lobbies, to do direct bilateral negotiations with a lot of countries to secure markets for American products. And once a country does an agreement, it may actually be in contravention of the convention. But it is happening. But in the ultimate analysis, the reason I suggested that this was perhaps a false problem is that however much a national authority tries to control, we are all going to still go and see American movies because they're well made and we like them. Okay? You can't stop that. And Americans are still going to be able to produce and sell despite the convention. So in a way, it was useless to make such a fuss about the process, both on the European side and the third world side, if you like, and on the American side, because it's not going to make such a difference. Where the difference is going to come in is that there is now a framework for cultural policymaking that is linked to concrete things. That is not just blah, blah. It's not just general ideas. it really applies to fields, and a lot of the work that the committee now is doing, and the committee that runs the convention is meeting in 2 weeks' time in Paris, is to actually work out very concrete steps. For example, the European Union is working on how it can give preferential treatment within European legislation and European import regulations to products from Africa, Latin America, and Asia. Now, that is something very concrete. What do we do as, what will the 27 do to open their borders to products from those countries? What will they do in the budget of the European Commission to actually help countries in sub-Saharan Africa or in the Cono Sur of Latin America to develop film, television, book publishing, and so on? So that's the positive that's coming out of the process.
Sí, a mí me gusta. Gracias por la sua magnífica ponencia. A mí me gustaría darle una volta a unha cuestión que quedou apuntada e que para min entra dentro tamén desa retórica que se manexe habitualmente e que todos e todas pensamos que entendemos, pero que non responde aos mesmos criterios. E me refiro a ese punto que sinalaba de paso de falar dunha democratización a democracia. E como se entende eso, non? Porque todos oímos falar constantemente do acceso á cultura, da cultura como un dereito. Que significa, ao seu ver, se podríamos apuntar algo por aí para profundizar tamén cara a unha institución como esta que plantea un foro, que significa democracia, se é o mesmo que democratización, se é o mesmo que acceso á cultura ou un dereito á cultura, sobre todo vinculando co problema da legitimidade institucional. Porque de que legitimidade falamos? A que ven, digamos, de arriba marcada, por, en este caso, por exemplo, ¿no? Por un estatuto, por unha normativa, ou falamos desa legitimidade democrática con que criterios, ¿no? Creo que están vinculados, a mí me preocupa esa perspectiva, ¿no? Tendo en conta que a cultura, se eu entendín ben a súa ponencia, a parte da retórica é conflicto, ¿no? E por lo tanto hai que resolverlo de alguna forma, ¿eh? Gracias.
That's a very good and difficult question. This question of legitimidad institucional, I have an example from Paris, which in a way illustrates the whole argument. When the new Musée du Quai Branly, which is the old ethnographic collections, were transformed and housed in one of these great symbolic buildings. Now, every city in the world has to have its equivalent of the Guggenheim Bilbao. I mean, that has become the urtext, the icon of this process. So Jean Nouvel, a great French architect, builds this new museum. And then the museum designers, the conceptualizers of the museum, decide that they're not going to have an ethnographic approach to these ethnographic collections, but an aesthetic approach. And that was very much the thinking of Jacques Chirac, who loved Japanese art, and he said, look, we have these magnificent things. We don't want to say that they belong to this tribe, this group, such a century, and they were used for this. We just think they're beautiful. That's our aesthetic. And when the museum was opened, there was a lot of protests from other countries in Europe. Some were perhaps a little jealous. The French have gone and done something typically French, and so on and so forth. Now, what's interesting is that in France, if you look at the number of immigrant communities, there has been a huge internal success of that museum on the part of lots of people whose parents or grandparents were immigrants to France from different parts of the world. It could be the Arab world, it could be Africa, it could be the Pacific, Latin America, whatever. And there has been an appropriation. And so what I'm talking about in terms of institutional legitimacy is this process of how a local community appropriates the institutions and really feels that we are being represented. We are being recognized, we are being represented, and it doesn't matter if it is a discours savant, if an extremely learned curator puts on a display, your local person who doesn't know anything about that culture is not going to object. It depends on how the culture is presented, what the discourse is, how that discourse is articulated in terms that really give representation. I think what I might emphasize is that up to now, in most cultural institutions, you had a dominant paradigm of aesthetic quality or historical accuracy, always determined by the expert. Now you have got to combine that with an ethic of representation, that it is always a local group that is in some way going to feel that it is being represented or not represented in what is put forward as the national culture or the local culture. And the obvious, I'm looking for the right word. What happened, for example, in the United States with all of the rejection of the white canon, and there was a mixture of American blacks, women, feminists, all together, and so they were rejecting anything that was representative of old white males. So Socrates, Plato, Dante, Mozart, these are all old white males. And it became completely absurd. And the first to object were the best black scholars themselves, who said, this is crazy. I mean, we can't be in a world where we are rejecting all of this as being not us. We are something else, therefore we want to have this represented. We're now in a moment where the canons have to be more multiple. So it's not just that, but all right, you say, as Salman Rushdie does, Mozart belongs to all of us. We could be Austrian or French or Gallego or Indian or from Papua New Guinea. Mozart is part of a common heritage. Yet what we produce in Papua New Guinea, or what the local, the rural disappearing folk culture of this part of Spain has produced, is of comparable interest and needs to be recognized. I think it's that balance that you have to achieve. And there are a lot of cultural institutions that are achieving this and maintaining quality. Because I think at the end of the day, to use a cliche, nobody wants to sacrifice the quality of curatorship, of scholarship, as long as it is done in that open spirit. I hope that's something of a reply.
eu quería comentar algunha cousa tamén no sentido de conectar, non, a o que comentou Judistir co que xa foi avanzado no texto, porque, bueno, unha das cousas que habría que facer é agradecerlle a Judistir a concreción e o nivel de aplicación e de inserción do seu texto na reflexión que nos estábamos levando a cabo, o sea que é unha cousa que non é tan habitual que de alguna forma se traballase o texto e de alguna maneira fixese algo moi adecuado ao que nos pretendíamos. Entón, por ese lado, e logo o que quería comentar é unha cousa que non solamente vai orientado ao relator, sino que de alguna maneira é tamén promover unha apertura do debate sobre o texto, que ten que ver con moitas das cousas que decía él. Unha é a cuestión do valor económico da cultura e, digamos, como o debate foi derivando cara a restricción e, de alguma maneira, a considerar solamente ese elemento como central na cuestión de como concebimos a cultura. Entón, da mesma maneira que decía él, deberamos reflexionar, a meu xuicio, en dous sentidos aquí. Como aproveitamos ese novo valor económico da cultura como un elemento que lle permitiría dar unha nova centralidade á cuestión cultural, é dicir, como é unha cousa que de alguna maneira permite que a cultura non sexa algo decorativo, digamos, é máis ou menos prescindible das cuestións centrales de preocupación da sociedade, non? Como mayoritariamente foi de forma histórica, non? O sea, tiña un valor simbólico, era un ámbito de xestión, pero tampouco tiña demasiada centralidade cultura entendido como artes máis patrimonio, non en sentido amplio, sino, digamos, como sector, non? Entón, como a cuestión económica pode ter un valor, pero tamén como, de alguna forma, como somos capaces de que non se reduza a esa cuestión. Hai varias cousas nas que decía Judistir que teñen que ver co valor social, co valor con outros, pero tamén co valor intrínseco da propia cultura. Entón, eu creo que me parece que deberamos darlle unha volta a eso no sentido presente. É decir, en que medida tanto a cuestión da sociedade da información permite que reconcibamos a cuestión cultural cunha nova centralidade, e en que medida esta cuestión efectivamente da retórica de como pode servir isto para o novo patrón productivo, todo iso que se di nos documentos da Unión Europea, todo iso, como podemos facer eso realidade en dous sentidos, que tamén son os sentidos que se pretendía neste debate. Un, de cara ás políticas culturais, o documento que aquí está a debate é un documento que se vai trasladar aos responsables públicos. Segundo, como reflexión do propio sector sobre si mesmo, é dicir, que debemos facer, xa me poño en primeira persona, que debemos facer desde o sector cultural para tamén que se recoñeza ese valor de alguna forma, e que habería que avanzar para que a sociedade comprendese que ten este valor non solamente nas cousas medibles, aquelas cousas que son identificables como produto interior bruto, como emprego, senón todo o valor no mundo dos intangibles, como poñemos en valores eses intangibles que, de alguna forma, sempre intuitivamente todos decimos que ten, pero que ao final non somos capaces moito de trasladar ao conxunto da sociedade que ese valor efectivamente é algo que é estratégicamente interesante para o desenvolvemento da propia sociedade, non?
Non era cuestión. No. Making a point of, you know, about what's important. The debate about how you balance the intrinsic and in the instrumental, and this the third idea that you could introduce is institutional value, that is, independently of intrinsic and instrumental, there are cultural institutions, and this really applies to museums, libraries, and so on, that these institutions need to have a new, it seems to me, need to change the way they operate with their publics. And there are a lot of institutions in the world that do this. For example, when Beaubourg, the Pompidou Center, was established, there were howls of protest from the establishment, from parts of the establishment, who didn't think that this was right in terms of the canons of French culture to build something like the Centre Pompidou and to have the kinds of populist aims, you know, building on the first floor a library that would be open to everybody. What a terrible idea that seemed to some people. How can you do that in a center which is supposed to be the Centre National de Cultura, you know, the Culture Georges Pompidou? But people who thought about these institutions were quite right. They were giving ownership. They were giving buy-in to the people of Paris and to the people of France by doing this. So you've got the intrinsic, the instrumental, the institutional. And what has happened is that the instrumental was used a lot, particularly in the United Kingdom, which invented the whole cultural industry, the whole creative industries discourse. And in the last few years, you see ministers of culture in Britain actually backpedaling from that and saying, you know, we really believe that it is important to foreground the intrinsic values. Now, that's all very well to say rhetorically, and I can only reiterate the point that was made by David Throsby, which is that for the next couple of decades, for the last decade at least, and for the next couple of decades, we are simply going to have to use the economic agenda in a opportunistic sort of way, but be conscious about what we're doing, because the intrinsic value alone is only going to work in certain very specific circumstances. It will work in a situation of great wealth where an individual is in power and is inspired. It's the case of the city of New York, where Bloomberg, as mayor, Mayor Bloomberg of New York, has been more active and generous and visionary in terms of cultural provision than a lot of previous mayors have. But then that's because he's Bloomberg. It is, and because the city of New York is on a boom. Same thing with the invention of cultural policy in France in 1959. De Gaulle knew that this was a moment in which he felt that there had to be a strong cultural message. So again, you had a top-down approach for a bottom-up process. And then the third cas de figure is, of course, what happened in the communist world of Central Eastern Europe. There was great cultural vitality, not in any condition of great prosperity, but because it was dissent, because there was something to fight against. So I think in each case, you're having to look for what is going to give energy to the cultural cause, and there's no simple answer. But for us, I think in Western Europe, I think this idea of using the economic as a Trojan horse is the best we can do, given the way our politicians think.
Quería expresar dúas consideracións para someter a opinión dos presentes. Unha felicitación ao ponente polo seu texto que puden ler, estou en gran medida de acordo, como podía ser de outra maneira, e un laio, ¿no?, de que seguramente moita matización e moito enriquecemento do que aquí aporta nestas preguntas e respostas que está facendo desde que acabou un pouco a ponencia a Marco, pois que me perdo porque non entendo suficientemente o inglés como para alcanzar a entender o que está a decir, e o cual lamento, ¿no? O que quería decir, e fiando co que dixo Saime, para tratar de baixar un pouco a pelota ao pasto, ¿no?, e entrar un nivel de concreción do documento que elaboramos comúnmente, quería facer as seguintes dúas consideracións. A primeira é que coincido plenamente co que aporta vostede no texto, que di que seguramente é nos gobernos locais, nas cidades, nas vilas, donde, e sobre todo vostede fala das áreas metropolitanas, o que ocorre que seguramente na nosa realidade xeográfica política aínda as áreas metropolitanas non están o suficientemente asentadas, polo menos nos poderes políticos, para sacarlle ese rendimento de interacción política entre esas propias comunidades políticas, e si, en cambio, a nivel real, polo propia ciudadanía, que vive, traballa, disfruta da área metropolitana. Non? Pero bueno, volvendo ao que decía, seguramente nas cidades e nos gobernos locais donde se están aportando as experiencias e a producir as propostas máis eficaces e máis interesantes en política cultural. Eu considero que hai a vital importancia que tería, por un lado, tratar de conseguir un pacto social, un consenso político cidadán de que labor cultural deben acometer os poderes públicos, sobre todo a nivel local, dimensionando realmente o seu rol. Que rol deben de cumplir? Se chegáramos a un mínimo acordo de cal é o rol que deben asumir, seguramente teríamos moito avanzado na eficacia dos investimentos, do tempo, dos esforzos, do labor, ¿no? E segunda consideración, a vital importancia que teñen as mediacións, os mediadores. E cando falo de mediacións, refírome aos espazos, aos equipamentos, a localización, a xestión, a dinamización, a visibilización, o acceso, o disfrute, a importancia da oferta, dos programas, a súa pluralidade, a súa cualificación, a importancia dos intermediarios, os educadores, a escola, as familias, as asociacións, os programadores, a importancia da participación non só a contemplativa, obviamente, senón a protagonista, ¿no? Da cidadanía, das entidades asociativas, etc., das persoas, dos outsiders, incluso. E non só respecto, cando me refiro a participación, non me refiro aos produtos artísticos, senón a participación e a importancia de coprotagonizar ou convivir. Vale? E tamén a importancia nas mediacións, a hora de facer políticas activas que fan cidade, que fan comunidade. No diseño do espacio público, na sinalética, nas políticas de todo tipo que nos afectan no día a día. Que en media, entre o que deber ser e o que é, son en gran medida os poderes públicos que toman decisións, seguramente auspiciados polo mercado e por outros intereses, pero pouco, aínda moi pouco a cidadanía, ¿no? Entón aí é onde sí que se podía ver, ¿no? Esa é a primeira consideración. E a segunda, tratando de a ver si buscamos, albiscamos posibilidades, que pensa vostede da Agenda 21 da Cultura, la Agenda 21 da Cultura aprobada en Barcelona en el 2004, como hoja de ruta, como documento de gran valor, por lo menos pedagógico, o que trata de dar o hacer que tenga maior visibilidad la cultura en las políticas fundamentalmente locales, ¿no? Simplemente eso. Gracias.
I wish I had said all of what you just said. That was great. No. What I said was I... Sí, bueno.
No, entendo en gran medida, valoro enormemente o texto, pero hai cousas que seguramente está explicando que uno...
No, estaba diciendo que lo que usted ha dicho es muy bien. Entonces, ojalá que... I was saying, I wish I had said what you said. Do you understand? Because what you said in terms of what the public authority needs to do, I gave a conceptual overview, but if I were giving a practical set of advice, I would say exactly what you said. That it illustrates... This way in which the local cultural policy needs to be re-articulated. It seems to me that everything that you said in relation to issues of cultural citizenship, of belonging, of involving people as individuals and as groups, all of those things are, it seems to me, that is the blueprint. You, it seems to me, in my judgment, that you really tiene razón, visto muy bien. So thank you. I wonder if what you said is going to be recorded, because I'd like to have it in writing, okay? That's as far as your question goes, the first question or the first issue goes. On the second question, I think the Agenda 21, which was largely worked out by a young friend of mine called Jordi Pascual in Barcelona, and Jordi is in fact contributing on behalf of the network, Agenda 21, to a chapter in the volume around this question of Agenda 21 and sustainability. I think it's an excellent framework. The problem, it seems to me, is that within the organization of whatever it's called, I forget its exact name, the organization that has produced it, there doesn't seem to be enough of political clout on the part of the cultural operators. That is, Jordi Pascual and his group seem to be kind of marginal, and that the message that they have articulated is not being taken seriously enough by the leadership of the organization. But ever since the Agenda 21 was articulated, I've always thought that it was an excellent tool, but it's not a tool that's being used well enough yet. That's the problem.
No, entendí, no fundamental, entendí a problemática de esta entidade que está promovendo e todo eso tal, ¿no? Lo que ocurre
que en castellano ou en gallego mejor. É igual, pois en galego logo. O que ocurre é que ali onde se está implementando, onde está aplicando aqueles entidades locais que creen nas disposicións e no son articulado da Senda 21 para poñer esas bases que eu dicía que serían moi interesantes en termos de eficacia, ¿eh? De tempo, de esforzos, de recursos, en onde xerar expectativas que logo eso. Pois os resultados están sendo moi interesantes en Lille, en Cork, en Rosario, en moitas cidades onde estáse comprobando que é así, non? Polo tanto, sirve como cando temos dificultade para escribir de forma direita sobre o folio branco, pois poñemos unha pauta por detrás e podemos escribir e van salindo, e cando xa temos certa, quitamos a pauta e seguimos escribindo. Bueno, pois eso estáse demostrando que está servindo para eso, para chamar a atención de diversas políticas, de que a forma de facer comunidade, de facer cidade, é ser o máis transversais posibles, atendo un proxecto cultural, en sentido amplo, de comunidade, non? E estáse vendo que é así. Polo menos está dando moi bons resultados en múltiples aspectos, de acceso, de participación, de producción, etc., etc., non? E creo que van, en gran medida, ao cerne do que debe ser a acción cultural, que vai moito máis alá, por Dios, do tema da producción, do tema da xestión, que claro que sí, pero é todo na calidad de vida da ciudadanía, non? Entón, non sei.
Bueno, parabéns, se convertiu nun tópico, darlle os parabéns pola intervención. Encendeuseme algo cando usted estaba falando de París, gustoume a idea de París como metáfora, porque creo que tamén nos pode servir para, eu xa non boas reflexións de Héctor, non da cultura como debe ser, nin da democracia cultural, nin siquiera da Senda 21, senón da cultura pesada, da cultura dos contenedores, da cultura na que nos estamos gastando un montón de diñeiro que se está aí invertido, por exemplo, na Cidade da Cultura. Non sei se conoce, non?
Sí.
A Cidade da Cultura. E a mí me parece que, falando de dos contenedores que usted comentaba de París, que nós, o mellor, o que estamos facendo aquí 30 anos despois, o que estamos tratando de facer, o que estamos tratando de imitar, porque na periferia da periferia pasan fenómenos tamén curiosos, é que vamos a facer, por un lado, Bobuk, 30 anos despois, e por outro lado vamos a facer o Quai Branly, pero para a nosa propia cultura. É dicir, que vai haber aí un gran museo, contenedor, depósito, etnográfico, antropolóxico, pero de nós, para que nos vexamos nós, nos, claro, nós non colonizamos África, non temos por que poñer aí ningún tipo de culturas. E como ve vostede ese tipo de mega infraestructuras que van a condicionar de maneira real, porque aí si vai haber que poñer presupostos e algo máis que imaginación, sobre a proposta de diseño que ten ese gran aparato cultural que vai a ser, pois, nos próximos 25, 30 ou 50 anos, a nova catedral nosa da cultura, non?
I think you've identified a real issue here, and that is that this fashion for flagship projects, you refer to yourselves here as the periphery of Europe, but if you think of what's happening in China today, what's happening in Singapore, what's happening in Malaysia, all over the world, there is this what one of our authors, Lily Kong, who is from Singapore, calls a global script. There is a global script of building flagship projects, great temples. They could be opera houses, theaters, museums with famous architects, and so on. And the human history shows us that the pyramids, how old are the pyramids? And the pyramids, of course, were built for as tombs and also sacred places of kings. But all societies will have this urge, the monumental urge. We can't get around it. But at a moment when we are so reflexive about the needs of the individual and what all the needs are at the grassroots, it's very clear that in every situation locally, I think we need to fight the flagship projects. I think the flagship projects are draining enormous amounts of resources from the sorts of things that you were talking about. And so there's going to be a permanent tension.
and we have to be realistic that the politicians and the local decision makers and the sponsors are always going to like flagship projects. We're also going to like flagship projects. But at the same time, something of a balance. And that balance can only be achieved by struggle. We've got to organize in such a way that we say, well, there's a point beyond which you should not go in terms of this expenditures of public display. I think that's very clearly one of the areas in which we need to be very forceful. I agree with you fully.
Neste sentido, quixera plantear unha...
Subimos un pouco.
Ah, sí.
Flash and Roll sobre o efecto bandeira, que hai unha especie de global script, un guión global en que todas as partes están aparecendo.
Falou como un proxecto bandeira, proxectos moi visibles que están aparecendo en todo o mundo, que efectivamente poden romper ese equilibrio que é necesario entre unha certa necesidade de monumentalizar a cultura e os proxectos que estamos falando aquí máis a pé de obra, e que a maneira que ve de buscar ese equilibrio, combater ese tipo de proxectos, é dicir, facer unha loita na que se marque un punto a partir do cal non, digamos, de aquí non se pode pasar en investir tanto recursos públicos en proxectos de pantalla, non? De puros proxectos de imaxe. É dicir, que él cree que efectivamente é un proxecto que rompe ese equilibrio e que a única maneira agora de intentar restablecelo é a través de poñerse e de buscar alternativas a iso. Se resume en 20.
Muchas gracias.
Sí, conectando con estas últimas intervencións e con un aspecto que se apunta reiteradamente no texto, que se menciona especialmente no final do texto, que é esa perspectiva económica nun contexto de crise. E non sei se o abordamos suficientemente claro e correctamente no documento, e é que a valorización económica da cultura, resaltar a súa importancia para a vida da xente como un elemento fundamental de benestar, digamos así, leva a, nun contexto de crise, insistir na perspectiva de que as políticas son importantes, que a dotación de diñeiro público ten que ser mantido precisamente polo relevo que ten a cultura para a vida dos seres humanos. Pero, claro, evidentemente, nos vimos nun contexto en España e en Galicia en concreto, marcado porque un momento de gran afluencia e de riqueza, digamos así, levou a que, conxuntamente, ca politización da cultura, a que se produciran investimentos extraordinarios que son dificilmente sostibles económicamente, dificilmente sostibles mesmo do punto de vista ecolóxico. Isto se convirtiu nunha especie de, digamos, de buque insignia da construcción de grandes contenedores, onde hoxendía, cando un va por Europa, o primeiro que lle din en España están os mellores contenedores culturales de toda Europa. Claro, e vostede fala de oportunidades ao final. Non será este precisamente insistir na perspectiva de oportunidade de reintroducir a política como discusión de orientación precisamente do gasto público, da oportunidade de que temos que non só reorientar o gasto, senón precisamente diseñar contenedores que faciliten a participación en lugar destes macro contenedores que chaman a pasividade dun espectador como unha mosca que busca impresionar.
I'm not sure I understood what your question was. Did I understand right that you're saying now that these monumental structures have been constructed, what is the best that we can make of them?
Aprovechar la crisis, sí, para discutir
a oportunidade de seguir nesta
sí.
vía de
ah,
grandes
bueno, okay. Well, no, I
ou de microcontenedores que faciliten
sí.
a participación e a creación
sí.
cultural.
I think it is an ideal moment. The problem, however, is that they've been built already. And what are you going to do with them? They're there. But it seems to me that in any situation of economic difficulty, there's simply more of them are not going to be built. So that your argument that you've made is absolutely ripe to be made now. In a slightly analogous way, I have a relationship with a small art center in Santa Monica, in Los Angeles, which is called the 18th Street Art Center. It's very interesting. So if you Google 18th Street Art Center, you'll find it. And after the financial crisis, the art center is mainly for visual artists who have residencies, they have shows and so on. But it's also very political. It thinks about the issues. And after the financial crisis, they were very afraid that their funding base would drop. And it didn't drop, because a lot of private foundations and private funders said, look, for artists who are only interested in making money, that whose main purpose is to earn a lot of money from selling their paintings or their artworks, we know that the situation, we can't do anything about that. We can't buy their work. But you people are really performing a service for the community. You are even more necessary now. We leave the big prestige stuff. We won't buy artworks, but we will continue to give money to you, because in this situation of difficulty, you are giving more of a service to the local community in Santa Monica. So at least for the next year, they found that their funding was exactly the same, in fact, even a little larger. So in a way, the paradox of the financial decline meant that for a cultural activity that was less oriented to the marketplace and more oriented to the community, there was support. So in a strange sort of way, you might find that this is really the good moment to say, you know, nunca más, you know, never again will we have this kind of thing. But then of course, 20 years from now, 30 years from now, when there's an upswing and, you know, Spain becomes very rich again, then it'll all start, and we'll all be dead. So we won't be there to stop it.
Vou dicir que, efectivamente, que no momento de crisis xa se vai parar de construir eses macrocontendores, pois xa non hai, vai haber fondos, pero que tamén na crise hai unha oportunidade, pon un exemplo dun centro de arte en Santa Mónica, en Los Ángeles, que é moi centrado na comunidade e que tiña moito medo de ter menos fondos dos que estaban obtendo por causa da crise, e en cambio atopáronse con que moitos dos patrocinadores de arte, en vez de estar investindo en grandes compras de artistas carísimos, están investindo en estas iniciativas máis a pé de obra. De feito, bueno, con este exemplo mostraba que realmente non diminuiu a financiamento de patrocinadores privados e que por tanto que isto mostra que a crise económica tamén pode ser unha oportunidade justamente para revitalizar estas iniciativas culturais máis de base, creo.
Muy bien, pues si vos parece facemos aquí, agradecemos a intervención da ponencia e a contestación das preguntas moi acaídas para o noso debate, e facemos un descanso para tomar un café de retorno duns 30 minutos. Moitas gracias.